As they tried to strike, they refused to work and do as they were told.
Ah, said Johnny. It came together for him. One more piece of evidence that added up to the smoke on the belt buckle design. The Chinkos had been another race. They had worked long and hard for the Cyclos. Their reward had been extermination. It bore out his estimate of the Cyclo character. Johnny looked around at the shambles. The Chinkos must have been killed a long time ago.
See this gauge? Said Turl, pointing to the air bottle he had now filled. It registers 100 when the bottle is full. As it is used up, this needle goes down. When it gets as low as 5, you're in trouble and will run out of air. There's an hour of air in the bottle. Watch the gauge.
Seems like there should be 2 bottles and one should carry the pump, said Johnny. Turl looked at the air bottle and saw it had clamps on it for a mate, and there was a pocket for the pump. He had not bothered to look at the labels and directions on the bottle.
Shut up, animal,
Turl said. But he filled a second bottle, joined it to the first, and put the pump in the slot between them. Roughly, he put the mask and rig on Johnny.
Now, hear me, animal, said Turl. We are going inside the compound, and I am going to talk to a very important executive, his planet ship himself. You are to speak not one word, and you are going to do exactly what you are told to do. Understand, animal?
Johnny looked at him through the Chinko faceplate.
If you don't obey, said Turl, all I have to do is pull your face mask loose and you'll go into convulsions.
Turl didn't like the look he always got from those ice blue eyes. He yanked the lead rope.
Let's go, animal.
2. Numph was nervous. He looked at Turl uncertainly as the security chief entered.
Mutiny? Said Numph.
Not so far, said Turl.
What do you have there?
Said Numph. Turl yanked on the lead rope to pull Johnny from behind him.
I wanted to show you the man thing, said Turl.
Numph sat forward at his desk and stared. A nearly naked, unfurred animal. 2 arms, 2 legs. Yes, there was fur, on its head and lower face. Strange ice blue eyes.
Don't let it pee on the floor, said Numph.
Look at its hands, said Turl. Manually adept.
You sure there's no mutiny? Said Numph. The news was released this morning. I haven't heard any response from 2 continents yet. The mine site's there.
They probably aren't very pleased, but no mutiny yet. If you look at these hands...
I'll watch the ore output carefully, said Numph. They might try to cut that down.
Won't mean anything. We're pretty short of personnel, said Turl. There are no maintenance mechanics left in transport. They've all been transferred to operations to up production.
I'm told there's widespread unemployment on the home planet. Maybe I should pull in more personnel.
Turl sighed. Bumbling fool.
With reduced pay and no bonuses, and this planet being as awful as it is, I shouldn't think you'd get many takers. Now, this animal here...
Yes, that's so. I should have brought in more personnel before we cut the pay. You sure there's no mutiny?
Turl plunged.
Well, the best way to halt a mutiny is to promise upped production. And within a year, I think we can replace 50% of our outside machine and vehicle operators with these.
Damn, he wasn't getting through.
It hasn't peed on the floor, has it?
Said Numph, leaning forward to look.
Really, that thing smells bad.
It's these untanned hides it wears. It doesn't have any proper clothes.
Clothes? Would it wear clothes?
Yes, I believe it would, your planet ship. All it has right now is hides.
As a matter of fact, I have a couple of requisitions here. He advanced to the desk and laid them there for signature. Leverage, leverage. He didn't have any leverage on this fool.
I just had this place cleaned, said Numph. Now it will have to be ventilated thoroughly. What are these things?
He added, looking at the requisitions.
You wanted a demonstration that this man-thing could operate machines. One of those is for general supplies, and the other is for a vehicle.
They're marked urgent.
Well, we have to raise hope fast if we want to avoid a mutiny.
That's so.
Numph was reading the whole requisition form, even though he had seen thousands of them. Johnny stood patiently. Every detail of this interior was being taken in. The breathe gas ports, the material of the dome, the strips that held it together. These cyclos didn't wear masks inside, and for the first time he was seeing their faces. They were almost human faces, except they had bones for eyebrows and eyelids and lips. They had amber orb eyes like those of wolves. He was beginning to be able to read their emotions as they related to their expressions. When they had come down the compound halls, they had passed several cyclos, and these had looked at him with curiosity, but they had looked at Turl with outright hostility. Apparently, he had some special job or rank that wasn't popular. But then, all the relationships among these people were hostile, one to another. Numph eventually looked up.
You really think one of those things could run a machine?
You said you wanted a demonstration, said Turl. I have to have a vehicle to train it.
Oh, said Numph. Then it isn't trained yet. So how do you know?
Damn, thought Turl. This fool was worse than he had thought. But wait, there was something bothering Numph. There was something Numph was not talking about. The intuition of a security chief always sensed it.
Leverage, leverage. If he could know this, maybe he'd have leverage. He'd have to keep his eyes and ears open. It learned to operate an instruction machine very quickly, your planet ship.
Instruction?
Yes. It can read and write its own language now, and can speak, read, and write Cyclo.
No.
Turl turned to Johnny.
Greet his planet ship.
Johnny fastened his eyes on Turl. He said nothing.
Speak, said Turl loudly, and in an undertone added, You want that face mask ripped off?
Johnny said, I think Turl wants you to sign the requisitions so that I can be trained to operate a machine. If you ordered it, you should sign it. It was as though he had said nothing at all. Numph was looking out the window, thinking about something. Then his nostrils flared.
That thing certainly stinks.
It will be gone, said Turl, just as soon as I get the requisitions signed.
Yes, yes, said Numph.
He dashed initials on the forms. Turl took them quickly and started to leave. Numph leaned forward and looked.
It didn't pee on the floor, did it?
3. Turl had had no sleep and 2 fights already today, and he was in no mood for a third. The snow was drifting down on a gray-white day, covering the half-wrecked, small, bladed vehicle, deepening on the broad expanse beyond the zoo. The man-thing looked utterly ridiculous in the huge cyclo seat. Turl snorted. The first fight had been over the uniform requisition. The clothing shop foreman, a mangy halfwit named Druck, had maintained that the requisition was forged. He had even said that, knowing Turl, he did not doubt it, and he had had the effrontery to verify it with an administrator. Then, Druck had said he didn't have any uniforms that size, and he wasn't in the habit of outfitting midgets, and neither was the company. Cloth? Yes, he had cloth, but it was executive cloth. Then the animal had spoken up and said that under no circumstances would it wear purple. Turl had batted it, but it got up and said the same thing again. Leverage, leverage. Damn not having leverage on this animal.
But Turl had had an inspiration and had gone out to the old Chinko quarters and found a bale of the blue stuff the Chinkos had once worn. The tailor said it was trash, but he could think of no more arguments. It had taken an hour to hack out and fuse together two uniforms for the man-thing, and then it had refused to wear a regulation company buckle on the belt. Almost had a fit, in fact. Turl had had to go back to the Chinko quarters and dig around until he found what must have been an artifact, a small gold military buckle with an eagle and arrows on it. At least that made an impression on the man-thing. Its eyes had just about popped out. The second fight had been with Zut. First, Zut wouldn't talk at all. Then he finally condescended to look at the requisition. He pointed out that there were no registration numbers in the blanks provided and maintained that this authorized him to provide anything he cared to at his own discretion. He said Turl could have the wrecked bladed vehicle. It was a write-off, but it still ran. That was what had brought on the actual blows. Turl had hit Zt hard, and they had gone around and around for almost 5 minutes, blow and counter-blow. Turl had finally tripped over a tool dolly and gotten himself kicked. He had taken the wrecked bladed vehicle. He had to walk beside it, running it, to get it out through the garage atmosphere port. He now had the animal on it, and it looked like another fight. "What's this green stuff all over the seat and floor?" said Johnny. The gently falling snow was covering it, but it turned patches of the snow pale green as it dissolved. At first, Turl wasn't going to answer. Then his sadistic streak got the better of him.
"That's blood."
"It isn't red."
"Cyclo blood isn't red. It's real blood, and it's a proper color, green. Now shut up, animal. I'm going to tell you how..."
"What's all this charred stuff around the edges of this big circle?" And Johnny pointed to the edges where the canopy had once been. Turl hit him. Johnny almost flew off the huge high seat where he had been standing. But with some agility, he caught hold of a roll bar and didn't fall.
"I have to know," said Johnny when he caught his breath. "How can I be sure somebody didn't press the wrong button and blow this thing up?"
Turl sighed. The arms of the man-thing weren't long enough to reach the controls, and he'd have to stand up on the floor plates to run it.
"They didn't push any wrong button. It just blew up."
"But how? Something must have made it blow up." Then he realized that this was the vehicle that had killed a cyclo down on the landing field. He himself had heard it explode. Johnny pushed away some snow and sat down on the seat and looked the other way.
"All right," snarled Turl. "When these vehicles are run by cyclo operators, they have a transparent hood over them. That is needed for breathe gas. You won't be using any canopy or breathe gas animal, so it won't blow up."
"Yes, but why did it blow up? I have to know if I'm going to run the thing." Turl sighed, long and shudderingly. Exasperation made his fangs grate. The animal was sitting there looking the other way.
"Breathe gas," said Turl, "was under the canopy. They were loading gold ore, and it must have had a trace of uranium in it. There must have been a leak in the canopy or a crack, and the breathe gas touched the uranium and exploded."
"Uranium? Uranium?"
"You're pronouncing it wrong. It's uranium."
"How do you say it in English?"
That was enough.
"How the crap nebula would I know?" snapped Turl.
Johnny carefully didn't smile.
"Uranium. Uranium," he said to himself. "It blew up breathe gas."
And he had incidentally learned that Turl could not speak English.
"Which controls are which?" said Johnny.
Turl was mollified a trifle. At least the animal wasn't looking the other way.
"This button stops it. Learn that button good, and if anything else goes wrong, push it. This bar turns it to the left, that one to the right. This lever lifts the front blade. That one tilts it. The
The next one angles it. The red button backs it up.
Johnny stood on the floor plates. He made the front blade lift, tilt, and angle, peering over the hood each time to see what was happening. Then he made the blade lift well up.
"See that grove of trees over there?" said Turl. "Start it toward them, dead slow."
Turl walked beside the vehicle.
"Now stop it."
Johnny did.
"Now back it up."
Johnny did.
"Now go forward in a circle."
Johnny did. Although Turl seemed to think this was a small vehicle, the seat was 15 feet off the ground. The blade was 20 feet wide, and when it started up it shook not only itself, but the ground. Such was its heavy power.
"Now start pushing snow," said Turl, "just a couple of inches off the top."
It was very difficult at first, getting the blade to bite in varying degrees while the machine rolled forward. Turl watched. It was cold. He had had no sleep. His fangs ached where Zzt had landed a good one. He clambered up on the vehicle and took Johnny's rope and wrapped it around a roll bar, tying it at a distance where Johnny wouldn't be able to get to it. Johnny stopped the vehicle, ready for a breather.
"Why didn't Numph hear me speaking?"
asked Johnny.
"Shut up, animal."
"But I have to know. Maybe my accent is too bad."
"Your accent is awful, but that isn't the reason. You had a face mask on, and Numph is a bit deaf."
This was a plain, outright security chief lie. Numph had been able to hear all right, and the animal's face mask had not muffled his speech a bit. Numph had been distracted by something else. Something Turl did not know. And the reason Turl had had no sleep was that he had spent the entire night rummaging through dispatches, records, and Numph's files, trying to get to the bottom of it.
Leverage. Leverage. That's what Turl needed.
He had found nothing of importance, nothing at all.
But there was something.
Turl felt dead on his feet. He was going in to take a nap.
"I have some reports to write," said Turl. "You just keep this thing going around and practice with it. I'll be out soon."
Turl took a button camera out of his pocket and stuck it on the after roll bar, out of the animal's reach.
"Don't get any ideas. This vehicle only goes at a walk."
And he left. But the nap, aided by a heavy shot of Kerbango, was a bit longer than he intended, and it was nearly dark when he came lumbering hurriedly back. He stopped and stared. The practice field was all chewed up. But that wasn't the amazing thing. The animal had neatly knocked down half a dozen trees and pushed them all the way up the hill to the cage, where they were now stacked. More, he had used the blade drop to slice up the trees into sections a few feet long and slit them. The animal was sitting on the seat now, hunkered down out of the keening wind that had sprung up. Turl untied the rope and Johnny stood up.
"What's that all about?"
said Turl, pointing at the chopped up trees.
"Firewood," said Johnny. "Now that I'm untied, I will carry some into the cage."
"Firewood?"
"Let's say I'm tired of a diet of raw rat, my friend."
That night, having eaten his first cooked food in months and thawing the winter chill from his bones before the pleasant fire on the cage floor, Johnny heaved a sigh of relief. The new clothes were hung up on sticks to dry. He sat cross-legged, digging into his pouch. He drew out the gold metal disc, and then he reached for the gold belt buckle he had just acquired. He studied them. The bird with the arrows was essentially the same on each one, and now he could read the squiggles. The disc said, "The United States of America." The belt buckle said, "The United States Air Force." So, his people long ago had been a nation, and it had had a force of some sort devoted to the air. The Cyclos wore belt buckles that said they were members of the Intergalactic Mining Company. With a smile that would have frightened Turl had he seen it, Johnny supposed that he was, as of this minute, a member, the only member,
of the United States Air Force. He put the buckle carefully under a piece of robe he used for a pillow and lay for a long time looking at the dancing flames. 4. The mighty planet Cyclo, king of the galaxies, basked beneath the forceful rays of triple suns. The courier stood to the side of Intergalactic's transshipment receipt area, waiting. Above him, the mauve skies domed the purple hillsides of the horizon. All about him spread the smoke-spewing factories, the power lines, the tense and crackling might of the company. Machines and vehicles boiled in purposeful turmoil throughout the multi-layered roads and plains of the vast compound. In the distance lay the pyramidal shapes of the Imperial City. Spotted among the outlying hills were the compounds of many other companies, factories that spewed out their products to whole galaxies. Who would be elsewhere? Thought the courier. He sat astride his small ground-go, momentarily idle in his daily rounds, waiting. Who would want to live and toil on some forgotten light-gravity planet, wearing a mask, working under domes, driving pressurized vehicles, digging an alien soil, or, drafted, fighting some war on territory nobody cared about anyway? Not this Cyclo, that was for sure. A shrieking whistle pierced the day, the warning signal to get clear of the transshipment receipt platform, chasing away a fleet of blade, brush, and vacuum vehicles that had been clearing it. The courier automatically checked his own proximity. Good. He was outside the danger area. The network of lines and cables about the platform hummed. Then they shrieked into a crescendo that ended with a roaring explosion. Tons of ore materialized on the platform's surface, teleported in an instant across the galaxies. The courier gazed through the momentarily ionized air. Look at that. The incoming ore had a crust of whitish substance overlying it. The courier had seen it before from time to time. Somebody said it was called snow. Trickles of water took the place of the flakes. Imagine having to work and live on a crazy planet like that. The all-clear signal sounded, and the courier gunned his ground-go forward to the new ore heap. The receipt foreman rumbled out to the new pile of ore. Look at that, said the courier. Snow. The receipt foreman had seen it all, knew it all, and held junior couriers in contempt. It's bauxite, not snow. It had some snow on it when it landed. The receipt foreman scrambled over to the right side of the pile and fished around. He brought up a small dispatch box. Standing on the ore, he noted the box number on his clipboard and then brought it over to the courier. Blade vehicles were charging in on the new pile. The receipt foreman impatiently handed the clipboard to the courier, who signed. The box was thrown at him. He threw back the clipboard and it caught the receipt foreman on his massive chest. The courier gunned his ground-go and swiftly threaded his way through the incoming machines, speeding toward the Intergalactic Central Administration compound. A few minutes later, a clerk, carrying the box, walked into the office of Zaffin, junior assistant to the Deputy Director for Secondary Uninhabited Planets. The office was little more than a cubicle, for space at Intergalactic Central housed 300,000 administrative personnel. Zaffin was a young, ambitious executive. "What's that box doing wet?" he said. The clerk, who was about to set it down among papers, hastily withdrew it, got out a cloth, and dried it. He looked at the label. "It's from Earth. Must be raining there." "Typical," said Zaffin. "Where's that?" The clerk tactfully hit a projector button and a chart flared on the wall. The clerk shifted the focus, peered, and then put a claw on a small dot. Zaffin wasn't bothering to look. He had opened the dispatch box and was sorting the dispatches to different departments under him, zipping an initial on those that required it. He was almost finished when he held up a dispatch that required some work and couldn't just be initialed. He looked at it with distaste. "Green flashed urgent," said Zaffin. The clerk took it apologetically and read it. "It's just a request for information.
too high a priority, said Zaffin. He took it back. Here we have three wars in progress and somebody from, where?
Earth, said the clerk.
Who sent it?
The clerk took the dispatch back and looked. A security chief named Turl.
What's his record?
The clerk put his talons on a button console, and a wall slot clattered and then spat out a folder. The clerk handed it over.
Turl, said Zaffin. He frowned. Haven't I heard that name before?
The clerk took back the folder and looked at it. He requested a transfer about 5 months ago, our time.
Steel trap brain, said Zaffin. That's me.
And he meant it.
He took the folder back. Never forget a name.
He leafed through the papers.
Must be a dead dull place, Earth, and now a dispatch with the wrong priority.
The clerk took the folder back. Zaffin frowned.
Well, where's the dispatch?
On your desk, Your Honor.
Zaffin looked at it. He wants to know what connections... Numph? Numph?
The clerk worked the console and a screen flashed. Intergalactic Director, Earth.
This Turl wants to know what connections he has in the main office, said Zaffin.
The clerk pushed some more buttons. The screen flashed. The clerk said, He's the uncle of Knipe, Assistant Director of Accounting for Secondary Planets.
Well, write it on the dispatch and send it back.
It's also marked confidential, said the clerk.
Well, mark it confidential, said Zaffin.
He sat back, thinking. He turned his chair and looked out the window at the distant city. The breeze was cool and pleasant. It dissipated some of his irritation. Zaffin turned back to his desk.
Well, we won't discipline this, what's his name?
Turl, said the clerk.
Turl, said Zaffin. Just put it in his record that he assigns too high priorities to nonsense. He's simply young and ambitious and doesn't know much about being an executive. We don't need a lot of excess and incorrect administration around here. You understand that?
The clerk said that he did and backed out with the box and its contents. He wrote into Turl's record, Assigns too high priorities to nonsense. Young, ambitious, and unskilled as an executive. Ignore further communications.
The clerk grinned wickedly in his own little cubicle as he realized the description also fit Zaffin. He put the answer to Turl's dispatch on it in a precise clerkly calligraphy and didn't even bother to file a copy. In a few days, it would be teleported back to Earth. The mighty, imperious, and arrogant world of Cyclo hummed on. 5. The day for the demonstration had arrived, and Turl went into a flurry of activity. Up early, he had again put the animal through its paces. He had made it drive the blade machine up and down and around. Turl had pushed it so hard that the machine had finally run out of fuel. Well, he could fix that. He went to see Zt.
You don't have a requisition, said Zt.
But it's just a fuel cartridge.
I know. But I have to account for them.
Turl grated his fangs.
Leverage. All was leverage, and he didn't have anything at all on Zt.
Suddenly, Zt halted what he was doing. There was a flicker of a smile on his mouth bones. It made Turl suspicious.
Tell you what I will do, said Zt. After all, you did give up 5 recon drones. I'll just check out that blade machine.
Zt put on a face mask and Turl followed him outside. The animal was sitting on the machine, collared, the lead rope firmly fastened to a roll bar. It was kind of bluish and shivering in the bitter wind of late winter. Turl ignored it. The hood popped up as Zt released the catches.
I'll just make sure it's all functional, he said, his voice muffled by his face mask and further muffled because his head was in the motor mounts. Old machine. It's a wrecked machine, said Turl.
Yes, said Zt, busily pulling and pushing connections.
But you got it, didn't you?
The animal was watching everything Zt did.
It was standing there on the top edge of the instrument panel, looking down.
You left a wire loose, said the animal.
Ah, so I did, said Zt. You talk?
I think you heard me.
Yes, I did hear you, said Zt. And I also heard no proper polite phrases.
Turl snorted.
It's just an animal. What do you mean, polite phrases? To a mechanic? Well, there, said Zt,
ignoring Turl.
I think that will be fine in there.
He pulled out a power cartridge and shoved it into the casing and screwed on the cap.
Start it up.
Turl reached over and pushed a button and the machine seemed to run all right. Zt turned it off for him.
I understand you're giving some kind of a demonstration today. I never seen no animal drive. Mind if I come out and watch?
Turl eyed him. He didn't have any leverage on Zt, and all this cooperation and interest was out of character. But he couldn't put a talon on anything wrong.
Come ahead, he grunted. It'll take place here in an hour.
He would kick himself later, but right now he had a lot on his mind.
Could I get warmed up? Said Johnny.
Shut up, animal, said Turl,
and he rushed off into the compound. Nervously, Turl waited in the outer office of Numph. One of the clerks had announced him, but there had been no invitation to enter. Finally, after 45 minutes, he scowled another clerk into announcing him again, and this time he was signaled to enter. Numph had nothing on his desk but a saucepan of Kerbango. He was looking at the mountain view through the canopy wall. Turl scratched his belt to make a small noise. Numph eventually turned around and gave him an absent look.
The demonstration you ordered can take place right away, said Turl. Everything is already your planet ship. Does this project have a number? Said Numph.
Turl hastily made up a number.
Project 39A, your planet ship. I thought that had to do with new site recruitment.
Turl had saved himself by adding an A, which no projects had.
That was probably 39. This is 39A. Substitution of personnel. Ah, yes. Transferring more personnel from home. No, your planet ship. You remember the animal, of course.
Recollection cut into Numph's fog.
Ah, yes, the animal.
And he just sat there.
Leverage, leverage, thought Turl.
He had no leverage on this old fool. He had combed the offices inside and out and could find none. The home office had merely said he was the uncle of Nipe, assistant director of accounting for secondary planets. All this meant, apparently, was that he had his job by influence and was a known incompetent. At least, that was all Turl could make out of it. Obviously, Numph was not going to stir. Turl could see his plans crumbling. He would wind up just vaporizing that damned animal and forgetting it. And all for lack of leverage. Behind his impassive face, Turl was thinking so hard sparks were flashing internally.
I'm afraid, said Numph, that...
Hastily, Turl interrupted.
Don't let him say it. Don't let him condemn me to this planet.
The inspiration was on his lips in a miraculous bypass of his thinking.
Have you heard from your nephew lately?
He said. He meant it socially. He was about to add a lie that he had known Nipe in school. But the effect was out of proportion. Numph jerked forward and looked at him closely. It was not much of a jerk, but it was enough.
There was something there.
Turl said nothing. Numph kept looking at him, seeming to wait.
Was Numph afraid?
He had started to say so, but that was a figure of speech.
There's no reason to be afraid of the animal,
said Turl, smoothly, easily, deliberately misinterpreting things.
It doesn't bite or scratch.
Numph just kept on sitting there. But what was that in his eyes?
You ordered the demonstration and it's already your planet ship. Ah, yes, the demonstration,
if you'll just get a mask and come outside.
Ah, yes, of course.
The intergalactic head of the planet drank off the Kerbango in steady gulps, got up, and took his face mask off the wall. He went into the hall and signaled some of his staff to put on their breathe masks and follow, and then, with many slit-eyed, darting glances at Turl, he walked with him to the outside air. A mystified Turl was jubilant, nevertheless. The old fellow positively reeked with fear. The plan was going to come off. 6. Johnny sat high on the blade machine. The aching cold wind blew puffs of snow, momentarily obscuring the compound. Johnny's attention was caught by the approaching crowd. Their combined footfalls made the earth shake. The place chosen for the demonstration was a small plateau jutting out from the compound. It was a few thousand square feet in extent, but ended in a sharp-edged cliff that dropped more than 200 feet into a ravine. There was room to maneuver, but one had to stay away from that edge. Turl came stomping toward him through the light snow. He stepped up on the lower frame of the blade machine to put his huge face near Johnny's.
"See that crowd?" said Turl.
Johnny looked at them. They were gathered by the compound.
Zt was over to their left. "See this speaker?" said Turl.
He jostled a speaking horn thing in his hand. He had used it before in the drilling.
"See this blaster?"
said Turl, and he patted a belt handgun he had buckled on, a huge thing.
"If you do one thing wrong," said Turl, "or foul up in any way, I will gun you right off that rig. You'll be very dead. Splatter dead."
Turl reached up and made sure the leash was secure. He had wrapped it around the roll bar and welded the end to the rear bumper. It didn't leave much room for Johnny to move. His instructions had gone unheard by the small crowd. Now, Turl approached them and turned, stood with his huge feet apart, seemed to swell, and yelled,
"Start it up!"
Johnny started it up. He felt uneasy. A sixth sense was biting him, like when you had a puma behind you that you hadn't seen. It wasn't Turl's threats. It was something else. He looked over the crowd.
"Raise the blade," roared Turl through the horn.
Johnny did.
"Lower the blade."
Johnny did.
"Roll it ahead."
Johnny did.
"Back it up."
Johnny did.
"Put it in a circle."
Johnny did.
"Now build a mound of snow from all angles."
Johnny started maneuvering, handling the controls, taking light scrapes of snow, pushing them to a center. He was doing better than just making a mound. He was building a square-sided pile and leveling off its top. He worked rapidly, backing up, pushing in more snow. The precisely geometric mound took shape. He had just one more run to make inward, a run that would carry him toward the cliff a few hundred feet away. Suddenly, the controls did not respond. There had been a prolonged whirring whine in the guts of the control box, and every knob and lever on the control panel went slack. The blade machine yawed to the right, yawed to the left. Johnny hammered at the slack controls. Nothing bit. The blade abruptly rose high in the air. The machine rumbled relentlessly forward and rose up to the top of the pile, almost somersaulted over backward. At the top, it slammed down flat. Then it almost did a forward flip as it went down the other side. It was rolling straight toward the cliff edge. Johnny punched the kill button time after time, but it had no effect on the roaring engine. He fought the controls. They stayed slack. Wildly, he looked back at the crowd. He got a fleeting impression of Zt far off to the side. The brute had something in its paw. Johnny strained at the collar that held him to this deadly machine. He tugged at the flexi rope. It was as unyielding as ever. The cliff edge was coming nearer. There was a manual blade control to his left, held by a hook. Johnny fought to get the hook loose. If he could drop the blade, it might stick and hold. The hook wouldn't let go.
Johnny grabbed in his pocket for a fire flint and banged the flint against the hook. The hook let go. By its own weight, the scraper blade came down in a swooping arc and gouged into the rocky earth. The machine rocked and slowed. There was a small explosion under the hood. An instant later, smoke shot up in the air, and a split second after that, a roaring tongue of flame rose. The cliff edge was only a few feet away. Johnny stared at it for an instant through the growing sheets of flame. The machine edged forward, buckling its scraper blade. Johnny whirled to the roll bar behind him. The flexi rope was wrapped around and around it. Pressing the rope against the metal, he attacked it with the flint. He had tried it before with no success, but on the verge of being yanked in flames 200 feet down, hope was all he had left. His back was getting scorched. He turned to face front. The instrument panel was beginning to glow red hot. The machine inched closer to the edge. Small explosions sounded as instruments burst. The searing metal of the panel's upper edge was glowing with heat. Johnny grabbed what slack he had on the flexi rope and held it against the red-hot metal edge. The rope began to melt. It took all his willpower to hold his hands there. The flexi rope dripped molten drops. The machine teetered. At any moment, the blade was going to go into vacant space to shoot the machine into thin air. The flexi rope parted. Johnny went off the machine in a long dive and rolled. With a shuddering groan, the last support of the blade snapped. Flames geysered. As though shot from a catapult, the machine leaped into empty space. It struck far below on the slope, bounced, plunged to a stop, and was consumed in fire. Johnny pressed his burned hands into the cooling snow. 7. Turl was looking for Zt. When the machine finally went over, Turl had looked around in sudden suspicion, but Zt wasn't there. The crowd had laughed, especially at the last part of it when the machine went, and their laughter was like daggers in Turl's ears. Numph just stood there shaking his head. He seemed almost cheerful when he commented to Turl, "Well, just shows you what animals can do." Only then had he laughed. "They pee on the floor." They had drifted back to their offices, and Turl was now searching the transport compound. In the underground floors, he walked past rows and rows of out-of-use vehicles, battle planes, trucks, blade scrapers. Yes, and ground cars, some of them quite posh. It had not struck him before how villainous was Zt's pawing off on him, that old wreck of a Mark II. He searched fruitlessly for half an hour and then decided to try the repair room again. Seething, he stomped into it and stared around. His ear bones picked up a tiny whisper of metal on metal. He knew that sound. It was the safety slide being pulled back on a blaster.
"Stand right there," said Zt. "Keep your paws well away from your belt gun."
Turl turned. Zt had been standing just inside a dark tool locker. Turl was boiling.
"You installed a remote control when you fixed that motor."
"Why not?" said Zt. "And a remote destruct charge as well."
Turl was incredulous.
"You admit it."
"No witnesses here. Your word, my word, means nothing."
"But it was your own machine."
"Written off. Plenty of machines."
"But why did you do it?"
"I thought it was pretty clever, actually."
He stepped forward, holding the long-barreled blast gun in one hand.
"But why?" "You let our pay and bonuses be cut. If you didn't do it, you let it be done." "But look, if I could make animal operators, profits would come back."
"That's your idea."
"It's a good idea," snapped Turl.
"All right, I'll be frank. You ever try to keep machines going without mechanics? Your animal operators would have just messed up equipment. One just did, didn't it?"
"You messed that up," said Turl. "You realize that if this occurred on your report, you'd be out of work."
"It won't occur on my report. There are no witnesses. Numph even saw me walk off before the thing went wild. He would never forward the report. Besides, they all thought it was funny.
Lots of things can be funny, said Turl.
Zut motioned with the blaster barrel. Why don't you just walk out of here and have a nice crap?
Leverage, leverage, thought Turl. He was fresh out of it. He left the garage.
8. Johnny was a mound of misery in the cage. The monster had pitched him in there before going off. It was cold, but Johnny could not hold a flint in his hands to start a fire. His fingers were a mass of blisters, and somehow, right then, he didn't want much to do with fire. His face was scorched, eyebrows and beard singed away. Some of his hair was gone. The old Chinko uniform cloth must have been fireproof. It had not ignited or melted, thus saving body burns. Bless the Chinkos, poor devils. With their polite phrases and brightness, they had yet been exterminated. That was one lesson to be learned. Anyone who befriended or sought to cooperate with the Cyclos was doomed from the beginning. Turl had not made one motion in the direction of that burning vehicle to salvage him, knowing he was tied to it. Compassion and decency were no part of the Cyclo character. Turl had even had a gun and could have shot the flexi rope in half. Johnny felt the ground rumble. The monster was in the cage. A boot toe turned him over. Slitted amber eyes appraised him.
You'll live, grunted Turl indifferently. How long will it take you to get well?
Johnny said nothing. He just looked up at Turl.
You're stupid, said Turl. You don't know anything about remote controls.
And what could I have done tied to the seat? Said Johnny.
Zit, that bastard. Put a remote control under the hood. And a firebomb.
How was I supposed to see that?
You could have inspected.
Johnny smiled thinly.
Tied to the cab? You know now. When we do it again, I'll...
There won't be any again, said Johnny. Turl loomed over him, looking down. Not under these conditions, said Johnny.
Shut up, animal.
Take off this collar. My neck is burned. Turl looked at the frayed flexi rope. He went out of the cage and came back with a small welding unit and a new coil of rope. It wasn't flexi rope. It was thinner and metallic. He burned off the old rope and welded the new one on, ignoring Johnny's effort to twist away from the flame. He fixed the far end of the new rope into a loop and dropped it over the high cage bar out of reach. With Johnny's eyes burning holes in his back, Turl went out of the cage and locked the door. Johnny wrapped himself in the dirty fur of a robe and lay in sodden misery beneath the newly fallen snow. Chapter 4 1 It had been a very bad winter in the mountains. Snow slides had early blocked the passes into the high meadow. Chrissy sat quietly and forlornly in front of the council in the courthouse. The wind whined and moaned through the gaps in the walls, and the fire that had been built in the center of the room sent harried palls of smoke into the faces of the council. Parson Staffer lay very ill in a nearby hut. The winter had sapped what little vitality he had, and his place was taken by the older Jimson man they were now calling Parson. Jimson was flanked by an elder named Clay and by Brown Limper Staffer, who seemed to be acting as a council member, even though he was far too young and club-footed. He had begun to sit in for Parson Staffer when he became ill and had just stayed on, grown into a council member now. The three men sat on an old bench. Chrissy, across the fire from them, was not paying much attention. She had had a horrible nightmare 2 nights ago, a nightmare that had yanked her, sweating, out of sleep and left her trembling ever since. She had dreamed that Johnny had been consumed in fire. He had been calling her name, and it still sounded in her ears. "It's just plain foolishness," Parson Jimson was saying to her.
there are 3 young men who want to marry you, and you have no right whatever to refuse them. The village population is dwindling in size. Only 30 have survived the winter. This is not a time to be thinking only of yourself." Chrissy numbly realized he was talking to her. She made an effort to gather the words in, something about population. 2 babies had been born that winter, and 2 babies had died. The young men had not driven many cattle up from the plains before the pass closed, and the village was half-starved. If Johnny had been here...
"When spring comes," said Chrissy, "I'm going down on the plains to find Johnny."
This was no shock to the council. They had heard her say it several times since Johnny left. Brown Limper looked through the smoke at her. He had a faint sneer on his lips. The council tolerated him because he didn't ever say much, and because he brought them water and food when meetings were too long. But he couldn't resist.
"We all know Johnny must be dead. The monsters must have got him."
Jimson and Clay frowned at him. He had been the one who brought their attention to the fact that Chrissy refused to marry any of the young men. Clay wondered whether Brown Limper didn't have a personal stake in this. Chrissy rallied from her misery.
"His horses didn't come home."
"Maybe the monsters got them too," said Brown Limper.
"Johnny did not believe there were any monsters," said Chrissy. "He went to find the great village of the legend."
"Oh, there are monsters, all right," said Jimson. "It is blasphemy to doubt the legends."
"Then," said Chrissy, "why don't they come here?"
"The mountains are holy," said Jimson.
"The snow," said Brown Limper, "closed the passes before the horses could come home. That is, if the monsters didn't get them too."
The older men looked at him, frowning him to silence. "Chrissy," said Parson Jimson, "you are to put aside this foolishness and permit the young men to court you. It is quite obvious that Johnny Goodboy Tyler is gone."
"When the year has gone by," said Chrissy, "I shall go down to the plains."
"Chrissy," said Clay, "this is simply a suicidal idea."
Chrissy looked into the fire. Johnny's scream echoed in her ears from the nightmare. It was completely true what they said. She did not want to live if Johnny was dead. And then the sound of the scream died away, and she seemed to hear him whisper her name. She looked up with a trace of defiance.
"He is not dead," said Chrissy.
The 3 council members looked at each other. They had not prevailed. They would try again some other day. They ignored her and fell to discussing the fact that Parson Staffer wanted a funeral when he died. There wouldn't be much in the way of food, and there were problems of digging in the frozen ground. Of course, he was entitled to a funeral, for he had been parson and maybe even mayor for many years. But there were problems. Chrissy realized she was dismissed, and she got up, eyes red with more than smoke, and walked to the courthouse door. She wrapped the bearskin more tightly about her and looked up at the wintry sky. When the constellation was in that same place in spring, she would go. The wind was cutting keen, and she pulled the bearskin even tighter. Johnny had given her the bearskin, and she fingered it. She would get busy and make him some new buckskin clothes. She would prepare packs. She would not let them eat the last 2 horses. When the time came, she would be all ready to go, and she would go. A blast of wind from High Peak chilled her, mocked her. Nevertheless, when the time came, she would go. 2. Turl was in a furious burst of activity. He hardly slept. He left the Kerbango alone. The doom of years of exile on this cursed planet haunted him. Each time he slowed his pace, he collided with the horrible thought, and it jabbed him into even greater efforts.
Leverage, leverage.
He conceived himself to be a pauper in leverage. He had a few things on employees here and there, but they were minor things. Peccadillos with some of the cyclo female clerks. Drunkenness on the job leading to breakage. Tapes of mutterings about foremen. Personal letters smuggled into the teleportation of ore, but nothing big. this was not the kind of thing personal fortunes were easily built from. Yet here were thousands of cyclos, and his experience as a security officer told him the odds in favor of finding blackmail material were large. The company did not hire angels. It hired miners and mining administrators, and it hired them tough. In some cases, particularly on a planet like this, no favored spot, the company even winked at taking on ex-criminals. It was a criticism of himself, no less, that he could not get more blackmail than he had. This Numph. Now, there was one. He had potential leverage on Numph, but Turl did not know what it was. He knew it had something to do with the nephew Knipe in home office accounting. But Turl could not dig out what it really was, and so he dared not push it. The risk lay in pretending to be wise to it and then, by some slip, revealing he didn't have the data. The leverage would go up in smoke, for Numph would know Turl had nothing, so he had to use it so sparingly that it was almost no use at all. Blast. As the days and weeks of winter went on, a new factor arose. His requests for information from the home planet were not being answered. Only that one scrap about Knipe. That was all. It was a trifle frightening. No answers. He could send green flash urgents until he wore out his pen, and there wasn't even an acknowledgement. He had even become sly and reported the discovery of a non-existent hoard of arms. Actually, it was just a couple of muzzle-loading bronze cannons some workmen had dug up in a mine site on the overseas continent. But Turl had worded the report in such a way that it was alarming, although it could be retracted with no damage to himself. A routine, essential report. And no acknowledgement had come back. None. He had investigated furiously to see whether other departmental reports got like treatment. They didn't. He had considered the possibility that Numph was removing reports from the teleportation box. Numph wasn't. Home Office knew he existed, that was for sure. They had confirmed the additional 10-year duty stretch and noted Numph's commendation affirmative, and had added the clause of company optional extension. So they knew he was alive, and there could not possibly be any action being taken against him, or he would have intercepted interrogatories about himself. There had been none. So without any hope of Home Office cooperation, it was obviously up to Turl to dig himself out. The ancient security maxim was ever present in his mind now. Where a situation is needed but doesn't exist, make one. His pockets bulged with button cameras, and his skill in hiding them was expert. Every picto recorder he could lay his paws on lined the shelves of his office, and he kept his door locked. Just now he was glued to a scope, observing the garage interior. He was waiting for Zzt to go to lunch. In his belt, Turl had the duplicate keys to the garage. Open beside him was the book of company regulations relating to the conduct of personnel, Security Volume 989, and it was open to Article 34A-4, Uniform Code of Penalties. The article said, "Wherein and whereas theft viciously affects profits," and there followed 5 pages of company theft penalties. "And whereas and wherefore company personnel also have rights to their monies, bonuses, and possessions," and there followed 1 page of different aspects of it, "the theft of personal monies from the quarters of employees by employees, when duly evidenced, shall carry the penalty of vaporization." That was the key to Turl's present operation. It didn't say theft went on record. It didn't say a word about when it happened as related to when it was to be punished. The key items were "when duly evidenced" and "vaporization." There was no judicial vaporization chamber on this planet, but that was no barrier. A blast gun could vaporize anyone with great thoroughness. There were 2 other clauses in that book that were important. "All company executives of whatever grade shall uphold these regulations." And "the enforcement of all such regulations shall be vested in the security officers, their assistants, deputies, and personnel." The earlier one included Numph. He could not even squeak.
The latter one meant Turl, the sole and only security officer, or deputy, or assistant, or personnel, on this